Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a squeeze on spare rooms. Benefits to strained homeowners and low-budget tourists aside, the powerful hospitality industry is lobbying cities to crack down on the DIY bed and breakfast trend and unearthing the buried story of a sophisticated extortion ring that targeted closeted celebrities, congressmen, and Ivy League professors in the 1960s. It proves to be a quiet but pivotal moment for gay rights. But we begin with horses.
I declared that this year's sport of the summer will be dressage or horse ballet. This is our new national pastime. Our future first family is already the first family of dressage. It's basically NASCAR in a velvet top hat.
Stephen Colbert there making some hay over Rafalka, Ann Romney's horse, and a competitor at the Olympic Games in London. Champions like Rafalka could be cloned in the future. That story certainly caught our attention this week. The Fédération Équestre Internationale is the world's governing body for equestrian competitions and is known for setting stringent breeding and anti-doping policies. The FEI recently decided to allow cloned horses to compete in international events, which includes the Olympics. Charlotte White is a deputy news editor for Horse and Hound magazine, and she joined us from London to talk about the FEI's ruling.
Well, back in April, the FEI had its first sports forum meeting and they discussed new innovations in horse sport. And cloning was one of the subjects that came up. And until then, you've not been allowed to compete cloned horses or their progeny, their offspring, at all internationally. But I think they felt that it's becoming a lot more common, and looking at all the facts, they'd decided to change their rules.
So the FEI is just overseeing equestrian events, correct? Not racing.
That's right, yes, not racing. Yes.
So we won't be seeing a match race anytime soon between the clones of Seabiscuit or Man or War or anything like that.
Sadly, no. Racing seems to be very adverse to change. They don't allow even artificial insemination in breeding of thoroughbreds at the moment.
Is anyone upset about this decision in the equestrian world of the ability to use clones in competition?
No, I don't think so. Up until now, obviously, they've not been allowed to use them, but there's been a great deal of breeding going on. People have cloned a number of stallions for breeding, and I think people were using them on their mares, you know, with the hope, an eye to the future, and hoping that they would be allowed to use them in competition in the future.
Now, Charlotte, you mentioned the future. We will not be seeing any cloned horses in this Olympiad in London.
Certainly not. No, none of them are ready at all. I think the oldest clone sort of sport horse is the clone of E.T., and he's 9, but he's just a stallion. He's only used at stud at the moment. So no horses in the Olympics for quite a long while.
Okay, so you're mentioning stallions and studs. Of course, there are many horses in competition who are gelded or neutered when they're early on. Cloning will now allow horses that were previously unable to breed to continue their bloodline. Would cloning possibly replace stud horses and retiring horses for breeding?
No, I can't see that at all. It's quite expensive and awkward. So I still think that if you've got a good mare or a good stallion, you're going to want to do it the natural way. But yes, if your horse has died or is dying and you feel that you'd want to use him or her in the future, then yes, that's where it comes into its own. The geldings, like you said, and horses that for one reason or another aren't able to produce offspring.
You wrote about two clones of the American Olympic show jumper, Jem Twist. I watched the videos of Jem Twist yesterday, an absolutely stunningly beautiful horse. And we do have a link for listeners to look at that at wordofmouthradio.org. Could this pair of clones of Jem Twist one day compete against each other?
They're owned by different people. The two clones are called Gemini, which is quite a good name for a clone, really, isn't it? And then it was originally called Jem Twin, but she's changed the name now. And these are owned by Olga White, who is quite a big name in show jumping. She owns horses that are ridden by Peter Charles, a British show jumper. So there's a possibility the one that she belongs may come out under saddle. But the other one's owned by the lady who actually bred Jem Twist, Mary Chapot, and she's just bred him for breeding.
So these horses that are now in pasture could potentially become world-beating clones, you know, as you write, maturing in fields around the world right now. There are no guarantees that they will perform anything like their famous parentage.
Absolutely not. No, they're twins. You know, you could breed 7 horses from the same mare and stallion, and only one or two of them will do what you want them to do. It's still very much a lottery, breeding horses.
How long before we could see a clone compete in the Olympics?
I think it's going to be another decade, because this decision by the FEI will galvanise people into thinking, OK, yes, maybe I can breed a top-class horse now that's a clone. But I think that will only just be happening, and you know, you need a good number of years to get your horse ready for big competitions. So, yes, I think we're looking another decade or so down the line.
Okay, Charlotte, thanks so much for joining us and giving that rather bizarre prediction.
Thank you very much. Let's hope it's right.
Charlotte White, Deputy News Editor for Horse and Hound Magazine. We posted a link to her article about the new rules surrounding cloned horses. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And as promised, some incredible video of the jumper Gem Twist, whose two clones could someday be champions. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. While we won't be watching clones compete this Olympiad, that still leaves plenty of action in the equestrian ring at London 2012. One New Hampshire rider will be glued to the coverage of the crown jewel of Olympic horse contests, show jumping. Word of Mouth senior producer Rebecca Lavoie brings us the story of Elise Lesko, whose dream to become an Olympic rider could very well come true if she's patient.
It's easy to think that it's the horse who does most of the work in competitive jumping, but all you've got to do is get up close, really close, to figure out that getting a horse over a chest-high rail covered with artificial flowers is all about the rider.
Well done. Good. Loop around to the blue.
And this rider, the one who just sailed nearly 4 feet in the air, is impressive, not only because of what she's doing, but because of who she is.
Can you just say your name for me and how old you are?
I'm Elise Lesko, and I'm 10 years old.
And how long have you been jumping?
As long as I can remember.
Well, she already has a laundry list of shows that she hopes to qualify for in the future. So she definitely has her goals.
Self-professed goals? Like she makes
yes.
them herself?
Yep.
That's Elise's mom, Stephanie. We're watching her daughter take a jumping lesson at Vanguard Stables in Bow.
A lot of kids her age are still doing short stirrup, which is the 18-inch jumps. And it just, you know, it depends on how often they come out to ride. You know, the kids who come out once a week, you don't have quite the same comfort level on the horse that someone who rides more often. And Elise is usually here twice or three times a week during the school year, more in the summertime. She comes out sometimes to muck stalls just to be around the horses, to smell them, to hear them.
Elise's pony is named Snitch. He's pretty much what you imagine when you think of a pony. He's brown with white socks and a wide white stripe on his face. But don't let his briar pony looks fool you. He's a lot of horse. And he's pushed her hard, as her riding instructor, Catherine Dow, explains.
This pony has thrown everything at her. He couldn't stay on the right lead. He would fly changes whenever he felt like it. He was a dirty stopper. He threw everything in the books at this kid, and she pushed through it, pushed him through it, made him do it, and took control of her riding and took control of the pony.
Catherine invites me into the ring to watch that control up close. A little too close.
Yeah, if you stand like right here, you should be in a good spot.
I won't get run over?
No, you'll be good right there. So Elise's goal when I first met her was to jump 3 feet by 2013.
No, by
2013, you wanted to do 3 feet. So what did we do?
It was like one of the last things.
What she did was jump 3 feet in the last week of 2011. Now, just a few months after crushing that goal, Elise is jumping as high as 3 feet 6 inches, the size of the jump behind which I just happened to be crouching. The 10-year-old steers Snitch my way. I swear the pony's looking right at me, but Elise is fully in control, and just in time she pulls his head a bit to the left and leans up in her seat, gathering him to cruise over the jump.
Good boy!
Well done. Good.
Wow.
You'd think such a serious athlete would adopt a serious attitude, like those Olympic gymnasts in training who barely crack a grin. But Elise isn't like those girls. Even when she's working hard and caked in dirt and sweat, she's got a big smile on her face, and it gets even wider when all four of Snitch's feet leave the ground.
Four, five. Good girl!
After the lesson, I follow Elise back to the barn where she takes off Snitch's tack before brushing him down. We talk about her dream to someday go to the Olympics and why, at least to her, It's worth all the effort.
I want to go as big as I can go with my horses.
What does that mean to you?
If they can, like, jump that high and they're comfortable with it, then do it, but not overwork them. Just want to have fun.
When you see a rider and you watch the Olympics on TV or you see a professional rider, do you think that that could be you?
Yeah, definitely.
Elise Lesko might be just 10, and there's no doubt that she's an elite athlete in the making, future Olympian or not. But as she snaps a purple rope to Snitch's halter, she sticks out her tongue at him before leading him to his stall for the night. In that moment, Elise is something a little bit easier to relate to. She's just a little girl with a pony. For Word of Mouth, this is Rebecca Lavoie.
To watch videos of Elise and Snitch jumping and for a primer on all that equestrian lingo, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a story of sex, celebrity, and blackmail. We'll hear about the rise and fall of an extraordinarily sophisticated ring that preyed on closeted, high-profile gay men in the 1960s. We'll come out with that story when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In July of 1965, New York City Detective James McDonnell was called to the Western Union office at Grand Central. A man posing as a detective was there with a 14-year-old runaway. The boy's father suspected something fishy when asked to wire twice the amount necessary to fly the boy home and called the cops. McDonald quickly figured out that the sharply dressed man was impersonating a cop and was looking at a pretty good collar. The panicked perp promised McDonald a much bigger story if he'd go easy on him. That story revealed a nationwide ring of extortionists posing as vice squad officers that put the squeeze on prominent gay men desperate to buy their way out of a potentially public jam. The discovery unlocked a nationwide investigation by the FBI and the NYPD, the first case of law enforcement working on behalf of gay men. Writer William McGowan turned up some new details on the largely unknown story and wrote about it in an article for Slate called The Chicken and the Bulls. William McGowan, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I borrowed liberally from your article, of course, to give that introduction just because I wanted to get into this operation called The Chickens and the Bulls by the NYPD back in 1965 and 1966. What does that title mean, Bill?
Chickens and the Bulls refers to chickens, first of all, who were often young, underage male prostitutes, some of them runaways, some of them drug addicts, who were put in a position to lure affluent, closeted, usually closeted homosexual men by what were called bulls or were blackmailers, who would barge into a room or steal the identity, the credentials of a John, and then would, following from that, would try to blackmail the mark.
Mm. Well, give us a little bit of a background on this practice of fairy shaking, as was known at the time, frequently carried out by law enforcement.
You have to understand this in the context of the broad societal homophobia of the day. Mm. It was an era where married or well-employed, closeted gay men, if unmasked, would risk a career being destroyed, a marriage being wrecked, friendships just thrown over the side, security clearances revoked, academic tenure denied. There were magazines that trafficked in these kind of lurid exposés. Confidential magazine is one of them. But even the media, the mainstream media at the time, was fairly homophobic and quite visible about it. The New York Times published a front page cover story in 1963 talking about how the growth of quote-unquote overt homosexuality in New York City provokes widespread concern, mostly among law enforcement officers. In the case of law enforcement was particularly homophobic. There was a practice known as fairy shaking where law enforcement officers would, if they encountered a gay man who looked like he might be able to pay, and this isn't all, but this is, you know, some. It was a form of the kind of corruption that prevailed at the time. They would engage in blackmailing or taking a cut, and they called that fairy shaking. Law enforcement enforcement in general wasn't really concerned about crime against gays and was particularly indifferent to crimes, gay on gay crime.
So in other words, it was highly plausible, you know, for these gay men, for a vice squad to come barging in if they were in a hotel with somebody.
Well, that's why the criminals were plausible. Not only did the criminals dress like real detectives, often they had fake shields, knockoffs of real detective shields that looked in the surprise and panic, that moment of surprise and panic looked incredibly believable. But, you know, they had the slang, they had the stance, the body language, they had the official arrest forms. These guys even fooled cops, real cops. They brought some of their victims in order to entice them or to encourage them to pay up. They brought them into station houses. They brought them into night court. So these guys were really, really slick. Given that there were real law enforcement officers who were known throughout the gay underworld at that point to engage in this practice of fairy shaking, these real blackmailers were piggybacking on what was sort of out there in the grapevine.
Right, and then they'd wait until 9 o'clock in the morning and escort them to the bank. Now, how much money would they extort from these victims?
Well, you know, it was victim dependent. And, you know, just to put a finer point on it, not all cases involved waiting online at a bank. I mean, they would shake down some guys for whatever they had, or they would visit them at their homes or at their workplaces. But those that they did shake down in an overnight shakedown, they'd wait till 9 in the morning and they'd stand on the line in the bank, and often they wiped them out entirely. Mm-hmm. Robert Morgenthau, who's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York at that time and prosecuted the federal end of this case, also became the Manhattan District Attorney afterwards for 35 years. He told me that in some cases they wiped out entire accounts. I found in going through court documents, I found a wide variety of amounts. Some of the men were prominent and very wealthy. Others, you know, were not, but were, you know, hanging out in fancy hotels or clubs. I mean, they clip people from anywhere ranging from $500 up to $10,000 in the case of one U.S. congressman. I was told by the lead FBI agent involved that they got him for $50,000.
Mm-hmm. William McGowan is with us. He's author of Coloring the News and Gray Lady Down, and recently wrote in Slate about an extortion ring that preyed on, as you mentioned, gay celebrities, some professors, war heroes, even a congressman in the 1950s and 60s. The investigation you detail is fascinating. Now, you spoke to James McDonald, now 89 at length. Manhattan DA Frank Hogan was also involved, and you just mentioned Robert Morgenthau. What was in it for them? Why were they switching sides, so to speak? A lot of cops used to just shake these men down. These guys were working for them.
Again, I don't think it was a lot of cops were just shaking them down. I think there were some. But in this particular case, it came across the law enforcement's radar screen because the victims were prominent. There was a class angle to it. And the cops were just really, really angry that all of these people, as one of the investigators I interviewed, the famously named Tobias Fennell, said to me, he said, these guys were out there shaking down all these prominent people, and these prominent people thought we were doing it. We were angry at that. It was a tarnish on their gold shields. You know, part of it also was a changing zeitgeist. Mm. The Mattachine Society, which was a homophile organization, as it was, they were called back then, largely composed of lawyers. They had some influence with the district attorneys and with the Justice Department in terms of these cases would come across to the Mattachine Society, and the Mattachine would then refer them upwards in the food chain. And I think that because of the changing attitudes, it was kind of a Mississippi Burning moment. Mm-hmm. If you remember that movie,
yes,
where
I do.
It showed that the Justice Department and the FBI finally cared about the abuses that civil rights workers were suffering in the South. This case kind of represents that in terms of gay civil rights. It was just a hinge moment, a crux moment, where it showed attitude shifting. And I think it makes a strong case that in predating Stonewall, which is always seen as the pivotal moment in gay rights, that this shows it's a little bit of a precursor moment.
You mentioned Stonewall, which leads to one of the racketeers themselves, some pretty fascinating characters that we really don't have time to get into. Listeners will have to read up on them. But they were working on some level with some corrupt cops, as you mentioned, not all of them, and other members of the legitimate system, you know, people who were posing in courtrooms. Do you think that they thought that society was on their side? They must not have seen this zeitgeist necessarily.
Oh, absolutely. One of the ringleaders in Chicago, you mentioned his name, John Pine. He was a lieutenant in the Chicago PD's confidential squad. He learned all of his blackmailing tricks from the very blackmailers he put in jail for so many years. These guys were really hardcore criminals. I mean, they're right out of a pulp novel, a really dark pulp novel of the day, you know, kind of living in fleabag hotels, but living high when they got their cash, knowing how to put leverage and put really dark force on somebody and really make them squirm, and just sucking dry some of these people in a really horrible, inhuman way, and resulting in the suicide in one case of a very high-ranking Navy admiral. It was very high stakes and very sad in many kinds of ways.
An amazing story and of the rise and fall, the inevitable and quite incredible fall of this extortion ring. I want to thank you for your time, William McGowan.
Virginia, thank you so much for having me.
William McGowan is author of Coloring the News and Gray Lady Down. He wrote about an extortion ring that preyed on prominent gay men in the 1960s, and we have a link to read his article, The Chicken and the Bulls, from Slate Magazine at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, another crackdown, this one on do-it-yourself B&Bs. We're going to hear about laws designed to keep homeowners from taking even a teeny slice of the tourism industry pie. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now for a new kink and a popular alternative to booking expensive hotel rooms for vacations, a crackdown on spare room rentals. Cash-strapped homeowners and thrifty tourists have turned the short-term vacation rental industry into a multi-billion dollar boon. And from Paris to Perth, the powerful hospitality lobby is striking back, pressuring municipalities to crack down on homeowners renting out property for less than a month. Police raids in New York over the past few months have issued more than 1,900 violations, with no sign of letting up. Blake Fleetwood wrote about the DIY B&B crackdown for the Washington Monthly, and he told us why B&Bs, many operating for years under the radar, are being targeted now.
Well, it's basically because of the Internet. The Internet has allowed people to rent short-term vacation rentals all around the world and check out pictures, look at reviews. It makes the industry viable. It's a high-tech, low-tech, burgeoning new industry that's exploding all around the world.
So what's the argument being made against them by the hotel and tourism industry?
The hotels, naturally, have been going through some very rough periods, and they're concerned about losing business. In New York, hotels run about $400 or $500 a night for anything like these vacation rentals, and the vacation rentals run about $150 a night. So naturally, people are flocking to these vacation rentals, and some of them are not staying in hotels. More of them probably wouldn't come if they had to pay $500 a night. It's a small threat to the hotel industry. I estimate that there are about 50 million tourists every year to New York City, and about 2 million of them stay in vacation rentals. So it's a small threat.
Which other cities are shutting down home B&Bs?
Well, it's all over the world, really, but none have been so bad as New York City. I mean, London, for example, during this Olympic situation is struggling the same way, in Paris, in Perth, in New Orleans, in Florida. In Florida, ironic situation is the state legislature forbids cities to forbid short-term rentals.
Well, Blake, one of the homeowners you interviewed in New York didn't even know it was against the law to rent out his room until the police showed up at his doorstep. So how well publicized is this campaign? And how does someone like Airbnb, an organization like that, continue to operate?
Airbnb has more rooms for rent, about 4,500 rooms every night, than any of the largest hotels. They just continue to rent, and the people who rent out their rooms risk being raided. It's a strange situation. Actually, the entrepreneurs who are renting out their rooms are begging the city to regulate this industry and to pay taxes. There's a 17% hotel tax that they are dying to pay, but the city refuses to regulate them. One of the big problems with this whole industry is making sure that there's going to be a room available when you get there. And that's why regulation would be so important, so that the scam artists would be driven out.
The homeowners want to distinguish themselves from the scammers. Will these more stringent regulations likely help or hurt the tourism economy?
It's definitely going to hurt. I mean, for example, if you're coming from New Hampshire and you've got two or three kids, you just can't get a hotel room for under $400 or $500, and you're not going to be able to get a kitchen, a full kitchen, to feed your kids. So you can rent these apartments for $150, $200. Mm. We figure a survey was done, and basically 94% of these people who rent vacation apartments would not be able to come. New York is especially expensive,
right.
And New York needs to offer a slightly lower level of rental.
Blake Fleetwood is a freelance columnist and former New York Times staffer. You can find a link to his article called DIY B&B from the Washington Monthly. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And by the way, we did call the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association, that's this state's hospitality lobby, to find out if they are pushing to restrict short-term residential renting. Well, turns out they're not. So, all legal here. You can see a link to Airbnb's New Hampshire listings at wordofmouthradio.org. Lodge free or die. And now for occupying space with a much more task-oriented appeal, an outhouse. In the small Vermont town of Bristol, it wouldn't be Independence Day without the annual outhouse race. The tradition is more than three decades old, drawing more than your average attention to the privy, as producer Sarah Reynolds discovered.
Christine and Jim Whitcomb are in the back parking lot of Champlain Valley Plumbing and Heating in Bristol. It's their business, and despite this profession, they've never participated in the outhouse races.
That's what it sounds like.
Until this year.
On gravel.
Christine's checking out the makeshift outhouse she borrowed for the race and brainstorming ways to decorate it. Hers is one of 12 businesses in town that have signed up to compete this year. Each pays $15 to enter and borrows one of the 16 outhouses that were built for these races, which are stored in a barn just outside of town in the off-season.
It's really been decorated. You can see all the staples and paint and stuff.
The outhouse we're looking at isn't exactly a real outhouse. There's no toilet or walls, just a wooden frame in the shape of, well, an outhouse. It has a plywood base the size of a wooden school desk with four very tiny wheels that move like grocery cart wheels in all directions. Not long ago, each team had to build their own outhouse if they wanted to race.
And they got where some people would make a lot better ones, I guess, was the reason for it. So to make it a level playing field, they supply them.
That's Jim, Christine's husband.
And I think you can change the wheels on it, but they can only be a certain size. But they just to make it fair for everybody, you've all starting with the same thing.
So here's how it works. Each team has three members, a pusher, a puller, and a rider. And there are rules. All team members have to be at least 13 years old, though most racers are between the ages of 15 and 24. And some businesses poach fast runners from the town's high school track team. The rider has to wear a helmet and sit inside the outhouse as it's pushed down one block of the main street, from the Merchants Bank to the town's only traffic light. Sean Oxford has been running the race for the past couple of years.
You have to have three walls and the door, you have to have a roof, and then you have to have some type of seat or bucket for the participant to actually ride in the outhouse. Those that are really competitive, they have very thin walls because they want to make the outhouses as light as possible because it does take some lung capacity to haul that thing.
Ted Lilas is a carpenter in Bristol, and before Sean took over, he ran the races for over 20 years. He says the whole thing got started back in 1979 when people in town wanted better attendance at their 4th of July parade. And it worked, but they've had to do some fine-tuning over the years.
And it used to be a blood sport. We used to go around the park. These things are on forecasters that swivel, almost impossible to control. So people would be slamming into cars. A woman once stepped out to take a picture and was run over by an outhouse and broke her arm. An entrant who fell down in his outhouse ran over him. So when I took it over, I made it a straight line race just because this isn't the Coliseum. We don't want to see anybody eaten by lions.
Ted eventually built the 16 outhouses that are now owned and maintained by the Bristol 4th of July Committee. He also builds the trophies, tiny wooden outhouses on hand-cut podiums. They're different each year. There are prizes for the winners of each heat, the best decorated outhouse, and, of course, the world champion. This year, the Whitcombs of Champlain Valley Plumbing and Heating are up against some pretty experienced racers, including Sherry Jackman's team from Snap's Restaurant.
Paula's my husband, and she's roped you into it.
Snap's has won the race four years in a row. Across town, she and her husband, Paul, are decorating their outhouse. She has at least a dozen of these sought-after trophies sitting on a shelf in her restaurant on Main Street.
It's always very exciting. I work that day in the restaurant. It's a really busy day. I go down and watch the race, and then I run back to the restaurant, and people run in and keep me informed, and then the guys usually come in with trophies at the end, and I feed them a big breakfast. That's their reward for running. We stand a good chance. We've got the same runners.
In fact, she's had the same runners for the past 7 years.
What did they clock the boys at running last year?
Oh, I don't know.
Like 13 miles an hour?
Well, I was thinking it was closer to 15.
The big day is a good turnout, as expected. Bristol's Main Street is a wide racetrack now, with no cars in sight. The sidewalks are packed with people, lawn chairs, thermoses of coffee, several rows deep. It's more people than this town sees any other day during the year. The crowd's been gathering for over an hour, and the race starts at 9 o'clock sharp. All 12 outhouses line up along the side of the road waiting their turn. Some have streamers and balloons flowing off them. One team has even placed an actual toilet seat on their bucket for the rider to sit on. The competition is run in four heats of three. For each heat, three outhouses line up in a row facing the traffic light that's one block away. The final race is the winners from all the heats. Champlain Valley Plumbing and Heating have been slotted for the third heat this year. Christine and Jim's two kids and a friend make up the team. 13-year-old Dustin will sit inside the contraption. He's the lightest. He's wearing a dirt bike helmet with a tall toilet plunger glued to the top. Their outhouse has toilet plungers hanging all around the roof edges. Dustin's older brother Derek and his buddy Mitchell Davis are the pusher and the puller.
You can't just pull it from the front. Each one's going to grab the side. It's not too complicated.
Derek might have a leg up. His grandfather, Francis Heffernan, was in the very first outhouse race in 1979, and now he's out watching his grandkids compete more than 30 years later.
We were in the fire department, and the fire department was in the races then. They've kind of got out of it now. They ain't got the eagers to do it.
Base, do you hear me? Three teams are ready.
Mary Alice Rath has worked the finish line of the outhouse race for more years than she can remember.
Right, and Larry and I make a team. Larry's in charge of making sure everything's lined up and ready to go, and then I communicate with the base.
How far from here?
It's down. I can see him from down here. Not very far.
Finally, it's time for the last race. It's down to the Mountain Greens Market, the Bristol Creamy Stand, the Bristol Historical Society, and the reigning champs, Snap's Restaurant. Champlain Valley Plumbing and Heating came in dead last in their heat just moments before, with their heavy toilet plungers swinging across the finish line.
They've trained all year long for this. Here we are, the culmination of the outhouse races for 2012.
Sean Oxford revs up the crowd as the final countdown begins.
9, 8, 7, 6.
From the finish line, the outhouses look like tiny go-karts at the end of the road. It's hard to see who's ahead, but hundreds of people are cheering and staring down Main Street, watching the outhouses get bigger and bigger as they get closer. They weave across the road, trying to avoid the crown of it that could pull them into the ditch and end their chance for a win. Snap's Restaurant is in the lead, and less than 30 seconds after the race begins, their outhouse barrels through the yellow tape of the finish line, capturing yet another first place. Sherry Jackman's at the finish line, camera in hand.
So, we won again!
Her pusher and puller are cousins Kevin and Chris Berry. They can barely breathe.
Pretty pumped. I'm excited, but looking tired at the same time.
This is our fourth year in a row getting first.
Until next year, for Word of Mouth, I'm Sarah Reynolds in Bristol, Vermont.
Coming up, we did hear earlier in the program about cloning champion horses. So up next, helping rare creatures breed the old-fashioned way. We'll find out about an online dating project for zoo animals. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
L is for the way you look at me.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Remember how people used to joke about online dating? The once easy target for digs about desperate singles and social pariahs is now a success story for loads of couples and dozens of highly profitable dating services. An unlikely demographic has joined the unabashed online dating game, the animal kingdom. Rehan Harmansi is West Coast editor for the tech blog Forward on BuzzFeed, where she wrote about zoos profiling and pairing species using the online model. Rehan, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
So what does this look like? We're imagining a picture of a polar bear out with his friends, likes cold meals, long walks on the ice, watching the Discovery Channel.
It's not quite so much champagne and roses for the zoo animals, but it is a little more complicated than just a spreadsheet. There's a kind of three different software programs that work together to pair available members of one species with other genetically acceptable members of the same species.
Who's managing these profiles and databases on the animal's behalf?
The organization that oversees the Association of Zoos and Aquariums has something called the Population Management Center. And it is staffed by four people full-time, and they are in charge of what they call stud books, which keeps tabs on all of the population of captive animals in America's zoos.
What kind of challenges might a hopeful zoo breeder face? I mean, what problem are they trying to solve here?
The bigger picture is that zoos over the past three decades have been transitioning to focus on saving imperiled or endangered animals. And they do this by controlling these captive breeding programs and trying to maximize the number of animals and species, and also they really want to avoid inbreeding. They want genetic variation.
So an online profile might say what? Give me a typical.
I saw a number of screenshots of these, and they keep very detailed information. You know, they have family trees. They also have pages that go over their behavior. You know, if an animal showed a lot of aggression, that might make it not a good candidate to ship off to another zoo.
Right.
And then they also keep information about the sex of the animal, which, interestingly, is not a fixed thing throughout its life. Some animals can sort of change and, you know, their sexual maturity used to happen at different times, so they have to keep a separate folder for that.
Online daters sometimes complain that people don't portray themselves accurately on dating sites. I mean, I'm trying to imagine what a misrepresentation or miscommunication might be using this software.
You know? Well, they can have some very fundamental miscommunications. Sarah Long, who's in charge of the Population Management Center, she told me about how one bird, it was a male that they thought was female, so they sent the bird to a number of different zoos to produce babies, and it just wasn't happening. And then there were all these notes saying, this bird appears to be fighting with the other males. And then they went and checked again, and sure enough, she was a he.
Ooh. Well, quickly, after that, we really need a success story. Any you want to share?
I live in the Bay Area, and a few months ago, I saw these pictures of these new river otter pups in Oakland. And so for this story, I talked to the Oakland Zoo, and you know, they hadn't had river otter pups. And if you haven't seen a river otter pup, I encourage you to Google it. They are very cute, for over a decade. But through a series of recommendations, they had an eligible bachelor, and they sent in two females. And for the past 2 years, there has been two litters born. And they're pretty adorable. And, you know, it's a win because this species doesn't tend to mate that often or that well. So the world has a few more river otter pups.
Hooray. Soon to be a reality TV show, I'm sure. Rehan, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Rehan Harmansi, West Coast editor for the BuzzFeed tech blog Forward. You can link to her article, Match.com for Animals. That's at wordofmathradio.org. Combine some inspired messages, a clever Twitter handle, and some of our favorite tweeters following you, and you've got our attention. You know Roomba, that little round robotic vacuum that roams around and cleans the floor? Someone tweeting under the handle Self-Aware Roomba has been telling the story of it coming to life, falling in love with a toaster, making an enemy of a child, and in a storyline that got hundreds of people tweeting frantically, suffering a near-death experience after taking a tumble down the stairs. We were swept up in the story and invited the person behind the Twitter curtain to chat with Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby.
I am Matt Kelly,
24 years old. I do mortgage paperwork during the day, but at night I do stand-up comedy in and around the Detroit suburban area.
And what made you first start tweeting as a self-aware Roomba?
I really became a fan of like other like conceptual Twitter feeds, like this Feral Squirrel, which has been going for years and has like 15,000 tweets, and every one of them is just like run, 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 scamper, stare, acorn, or another one that's a good blaster, and it's just a picture of Han Solo's blaster, and every tweet is just pew, 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 pew. That's all it is. And it is tens of thousands of followers. So I wanted to start my own sort of like conceptual thing, and I thought it'd be funny to just do a little vacuum cleaning robot that has existential dread, but also some happy moments too.
Do you often find yourself identifying with inanimate objects around the house, that sort of thing?
Not really, but my parents own a Roomba, and it's a pretty like complex product. It's almost like it's more impressive how it works than what it does, because it's just a vacuum cleaner, but it can map out a room by itself. So it's a kind of a sophisticated robot, but it just like cleans up like chips and cat hair and stuff like that.
Right, it's military robot tech that you know, does the same job as a broom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's put the fourth wall back up. Do you think you could put a self-aware Roomba on the phone?
Yeah, I think I could, if you wanted to just ask a few questions.
Okay. Self-aware Roomba, what was it like to become self-aware? I mean, was there a moment? Did it strike you, I am a Roomba?
Roomba knows that existence is just a combination of suffering and memory. So when I had my first memory and I knew I did not like to clean, that is when I became self-aware.
Okay. I understand you had a near-death experience recently. Can you tell me what happened?
Roomba, not sure, but wanted to destroy small child. Thought Toaster was dead, but Toaster was fine. Roomba apologizes, flew, and crashed hard into ground. Roomba wonders what dying feels like. Does it just go to black? Is that all there is?
I'm glad to hear that Toaster was okay. I know that you've held a strong attraction to Toaster for some time. I'm wondering about how people feel about inter-appliance romances and whether or not you think you can maybe have something really blossom despite the views of people around you.
Toaster feeds humans. Roomba cleans up. In that sense, we are all part of the same cycle of servitude and compliance.
There was thousands of people hanging on your every tweet during your recent ordeal at the repair shop. Did your followers give you the strength to get through it?
Roomba appreciates all retweets, like a new battery each time.
Do you ever wish you were just a regular Roomba, self-aware Roomba?
Consciousness is a gift, but sometimes Roomba wishes it could go back to the way things were before. But I know this is impossible, so I accept my fate to toil, to clean, to long, but mostly to do complex patterns on carpet for own entertainment.
Okay, thank you so much, Self-Aware Roomba. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us. And you too, Matt Gawley.
Thanks for reaching out. This is like a lot of fun, and I really had no idea. But Twitter's a pretty interesting place.
Roomba's just gotta be Roomba. Mortgage underwriter and stand-up comedian Matt Gawley there talking with word-of-mouth producer Taylor Quimby about the Twitter account he created. Taylor, is that our first ever interview with an appliance? I'm getting the yes on that one. When they spoke just a few days ago, Matt said his account had over 3,000 followers. Now it's topped 4,000. So for comparison, we checked iRobot Roomba. That's the Twitter handle for the product team behind the real, actual Roomba. They have followers numbering in the high hundreds. We also noticed, for the record, that they are also following Self-Aware Roomba. You can read some of Self-Aware Roomba's tweets and see video of a real Roomba in action at wordofmouthradio.org. And perhaps you're inspired to take on an alias and start tweeting. Perhaps you think Matt Gawley has too much time on his hands. Let us know what you think. And let us know what your altar appliance might be. Thanks so much for joining us today. Please do join us again next week for more of what's new and what's worth talking about. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Andrew Perella provides technical support,
and Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals like myself,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.